We're here today on the great American holiday weekend in which the nation celebrates its Declaration of Independence with these immortal words. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. These words and this declaration birthed a nation which guaranteed more freedoms than any other nation in the history of man. And we are very familiar with what is called the Bill of Rights, which are the first 10 amendments to the Constitution. These fundamental liberties changed the course of history and are memorialized in the U.S. Constitution. The first of these is this, quote, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press." Did I just die? No? Half of me did. Okay. All right. Can you still hear? All right. The first of these is, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech. I mean, these things are fundamental to what we should cherish in this country. Or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. This is fundamental to our privilege to be assembling here today without any fear that we will somehow be interrupted or hauled off as the apostles of old were. But did you know that one of the most cherished liberties enumerated in the Bill of Rights is in direct contradiction with one of the fundamental beliefs of the Church of God since apostolic times? And I don't know if you've ever thought of it that way. You know, there is one liberty in the Bill of Rights, the second one, that is fundamentally opposed to one of our fundamental beliefs. Here's what the Second Amendment says. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, that's the first part. The second part, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And this of course, has been in public discourse, particularly in the last election and even before that. And one of the things that our Constitution guarantees is that we have the right to bear arms. And that's something that is very particular to the United States. Most other countries don't have that freedom. But that is in direct contradiction to fundamental belief number 14 of the United Church of God. Note, we believe that Christians are forbidden by the commandments of God from taking human life directly or indirectly, and that bearing arms is contrary to this fundamental belief. Therefore, we believe that Christians should not voluntarily become engaged in military service. If they are involuntarily engaged in military service, we believe that they should refuse conscientiously to bear arms and, to the extent possible, refuse to come under military authority. That is fundamental belief number 14. So here we have two constitutions. One guarantees the right to bear arms, the other forbids it. Which one do you believe? More importantly, which one do you practice? When it comes to constitutions, personal opinions don't count, or at least they shouldn't. I mean, we rely on the fact that we have a constitution that guarantees our free exercise of religion, the freedom of speech. I mean, the freedom basically to make a fool of yourself when you speak. And that is a fundamental right that is not subject to opinion. That's what constitutions are for. It's not about my opinion or yours, it's what does it say. So we live in a country in which we have, on the one hand, the guarantee to bear arms, and we are part of a church that has as its fundamental belief not to bear arms. There seems to be some confusion in the church about this, and it came to my attention over the past several weeks in conversation. So I'm going to share two conversations I had in recent weeks that brought to my attention that this is a topic that probably needs some clarity. Conversation one went like this. I was having a conversation with a young adult in the church, and the topic of carrying concealed weapons came up. And I said, "We don't do that." He said, "Really?" And I said, "Really? What do you mean we do not do that? I know church members who carry concealed weapons. Actually, they carry them to church to protect the congregation, and the pastor knows about it." I thought, oh, okay, maybe. Conversation two. Last week we had Troyer's Hollow Camp Out with the young adults, and the topic somehow came up again. It wasn't planned, it just came up in conversation. And it was quickly apparent that Fundamental Belief 14 was not clearly understood. In fact, one of the young men said this. He said that in his congregation, he would estimate that 50% of the young men believe it is okay to use lethal force, in most cases a gun, to protect yourself. And I said, "Really? That's not the church I signed up for. That's not what we taught when I came into the church, and it's not what we teach today." I guess it's a reminder of the fact that we often assume that, you know, people just know, and often assume correctly that everybody believes the same thing, and are unaware at just how much the world around us affects us. So what I want to do this afternoon in the time that we share is to go through this fundamental belief and provide a context and a good background on why this has been the position of the Church of God since apostolic times and remains the position of the Church of God today. It hasn't changed, never will. Some people may have other opinions, that's fine. I don't care what your opinion is. I care about the truth. And if we, one thing that always happens, this is just a human dynamic. If we are ambivalent on any given topic, opinions will multiply. It will become unclear. What people do is a different question, but there should be clarity on what is the truth. So I'm going to try to help ourselves a little bit on that. So let me just reread again the fundamental of belief. We believe that Christians are forbidden by the commandment of God from taking human life, directly or indirectly, and that bearing arms is contrary to this fundamental belief. And this is kind of difficult to change. It's kind of the law of the Medes and Persians that can't change. I mean, we have, over the last number of years, looked at the maturities required to change fundamental beliefs, and, you know, we can't even pass an amendment to agree to disagree on how to how to change it. So, you know, this one ain't going away real soon. I can pretty much guarantee you that. Now, that doesn't mean, and obviously, we have a situation in which there are various opinions, and there'll always be that. You know, I think we are naive to think that other people think the way you and I think, and sometimes I'm not sure about you. You know, that is just the way things work. But there should be clarity. There should be no ambiguity, for example, on whether or not we need to keep the Sabbath. There may be all kinds of opinions as to how, That happens. And, people break God's commandments all the time. We as a church have a responsibility to clearly teach the truth. And then free moral agents, as human beings are created to be, will make their own choices with their own consequences. And this is no different with this. It really comes down, when it comes down to the use or non-use of lethal force or weapons or participating in military service and war, it comes down really to one fairly simple concept. We have the Constitution of the Church and the Constitution of this world. Which one takes precedent? And I would simply add, that the Bible takes precedent. Let's take a look at a couple of scriptures, and then I'll comment on this as we go along. John chapter 5, verse 29. Then Peter and the other apostles answered and said, "We ought to obey God rather than men." We ought to obey God rather than men. And he's before the council, and they are remanding him because they said, "Did we not, verse 28, strictly command you not to teach in this name? And look, you have filled Jerusalem with your doctrine and intend to bring this man's blood on us." They tried to intimidate the apostles into not doing the mission that Jesus Christ gave them to do. That's just the way of the world. Satan first tries to influence us, i.e. deceive us. If that doesn't work, then he will try to intimidate. And whenever you can't argue with facts, you begin to do these kinds of funny tricks. That's just the way the world works. I deal with that all the time. But fundamentally, what we need to think about as far as truth and error, faith and unbelief, is what has precedence. And I'm casting this, I think, appropriately because it's the 4th of July weekend, in the context of two constitutions. One guarantees the right to bear arms, the other forbids it. Philippians chapter 3. Philippians chapter 3, verse 20. "For our citizenship is in heaven, from which we also eagerly wait for the Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ." This is a fundamental anchor scripture that gives us direction on a number of very important issues. It makes the point of to whom and to what our allegiance must first of all be. When we're in this world, and if our citizenship is first in heaven, and if we are, as Paul wrote, ambassadors for Christ, it makes a very important distinction on what our perspective needs to be on issues such as the one that we are discussing, and other political issues for that matter. Because this world, all of it, the politicians of the United States are almost equally disgusting these days. It is an embarrassing display of what leadership is not. And nothing gets done. We need to remember that our citizenship is first in heaven. Now, that sounds like kind of a theoretical concept, you know. It's one of those things where you say, you know, I'm a citizen of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever does that mean? Well, it means quite a lot. Let's go over to John chapter 18. I mean, ideas and concepts have consequences, or they are, in fact, meaningless. John chapter 18. You know, these are, this particular passage is in a context that was very, very serious. John chapter 18, verse 35, Jesus is in front of Pilate. This was not a discussion, this was not a theoretical discussion. I mean, this was a life and death situation. And Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world." So Paul is simply echoing what Jesus Christ claimed here in John chapter 18 on the night of his crucifixion. But as I said, ideas, if they have any meaning, have consequences. And in this particular case, Jesus enumerates a consequence of the fact that his kingdom was not of this world. "If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I should not be delivered to the Jews, but now my kingdom is not from here." So here we see that the concept, or I should say the fact, that our kingdom is in heaven and our citizenship is retained there has real life consequences. In this particular case, he said that his servants would not fight. And he later that evening demonstrated that. In fact, you know, I mean, this is something, a question that sometimes comes up. I mean, first of all, Jesus told the disciples to take a sword. So they took a sword, and Peter, being of a particular personality, hacked off the high priest's servant's ear. Now, just to be clear, his intention was not to demonstrate his ability with the sword, meaning that he could just slice off an ear neatly. He really, what he wanted to do is to take his head off, and the servant dodged. Jesus Christ said what? "Put your sword away." So when Jesus told Pilate here that his servants would not fight, he provided a real-life demonstration that that was the case, and picked up the ear and healed it back onto the servant's head. I don't know how you could be much more clear than that, but you also notice here, and this provides, and I will digress here a little bit just to provide you a context. It says here that my kingdom now, but now my kingdom is not from here. So what is implied here is that for the period of time in which the kingdom is in heaven, and his servants are on earth, but citizens in heaven, they would not fight. And we will go to some quotes here in a minute that demonstrate the fact that the church of God, the real church, has always had this particular position. I would also like to give a little background from my perspective, having grown up Amish. One of the fundamental differentiators of the Anabaptist movement, I should say, which would include denominations like the Mennonites and the Amish, the Hutterites, and a few others, is that they are pacifists. And they come to the same conclusion that we do as a church, with a different theological argument. Their theological argument is that that of primarily the Sermon on the Mount, that Jesus gave the Beatitudes, taught them to love their neighbors, etc., etc., etc. And while that is all well and good and valid, it creates a bit of a conflict theologically, and here's the conflict. The conflict is, how do you then explain all the wars of the Old Testament and the fact that the Sixth Commandment states that you shall not murder, as opposed to, as some translations, I mean, if you stay strictly to the Hebrew, it is you shall not murder, even though some translations say you shall not kill. And that is a legitimate question. So when I was coming into the church, now decades ago, it's hard to believe, this was a real issue for me. So fundamental of belief number 14 has never been confusing to me, because that was part of what I understood and knew to be the truth. And in fact, there were a couple of things that I just figured would get me off the hook, to give you an idea of how the human mind of John Miller worked, at least back then. Once I became convicted that the Sabbath needed to be kept, I wanted to find an excuse why maybe I could justify not to. And the notion, you have to think about this, the idea that a church headquartered in California could possibly know the truth was a pretty foreign concept to an Amish kid. I mean, that's where the hippies lived, as far as we were concerned, and all kinds of other fruits and nuts. So there were a couple of things that I thought might get me off the hook, meaning, well, I mean, if they can do this, I mean, then, you know, maybe keeping the Sabbath isn't that important. So I worked the phone lines. I mean, I gave some of the girls out in the Watts line a hard way to go. I'd call and ask questions. And here were some of the questions. One of them was the military service in war and the use of lethal force. And I fired my questions, and the girls on the line gave me the answers succinctly. And it was like, and then I came up with a better plan. I thought, you know what? The Bible says that the Passover, there's got to be a foot washing. And the fact that women from California would wash each other's feet, I mean, that was my last straw. I mean, I figured there's no way. There's just no way that they would do that, you know? So I called the Watts line and asked about foot washing, and the answer was, yeah, we do that. We do it every year. And it's like, I don't have any excuse anymore. So what do you do? I'm sharing that with you because, you know, this was very important to me. So the difference in the theological argument, I said the conclusion is the same. The Church of God has, as the Anabaptists have for 500 years, conscientiously objected to participation in military service and war. The argument, though, is a little bit different. And I tried this morning to find, there was an article written by Dr. Hay years ago in which he was confronted on this issue and explained it to high-ranking military officers. And he used the citizenship argument, as the scriptures that we just read together. And that provides a much more cohesive theological framework, because it allows for the fact that when Israel was a civil nation in this world, that participating in war at that time was not murder. Okay, it was killing, but not murder. And there's also an interesting, if you look at the story of the Israelites and how it progressed, and how and what God's initial intent was and what they ended up doing, there's a pretty big contrast. God's initial intent was a relatively short hike to the promised land. And part of that initial intent was that he would go before them and drive out the Hivites and the Perizzites and all the other ites. But Israel insisted on doing it their own way, and as a consequence, that included fighting for themselves. But again, that was at a different time and in a completely different framework, and we have Jesus Christ himself saying with specificity here in John chapter 18 that my servants will not fight. So I'd like to dissect the fundamental of belief into three things that we read. The first one being, we believe that Christians. So there's a distinction here, and the distinction is that Christians, meaning true Christians, would not fight. And I don't know how we can argue about that. Let me read it to you again. Jesus answered Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight, so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here." You see, we're supposed to be different. That's our job. We're supposed to come out of this world to be ambassadors for Christ, and that makes us different. If you have a problem with that, you're at the wrong place. I mean, that's just how it is. You know, we're supposed to be different. And one of the differentiators is that since we are ambassadors for Christ, and since our citizenship is in heaven, we don't fight. And, you know, like I said, I thought that was widely understood, wrongly so, after having a number of conversations. I think we need to clarify this. People then have to make choices. Are you going to do it or aren't you? But the fact is the fact, and the truth is the truth. So the question becomes, you know, what do you do practically? I've always said, I hope I'm never in a situation where I am actually challenged to have to protect. I have a very protective personality. I mean, I don't know what I would do. I mean, if somebody came with a gun in his hand, I might do something really stupid, like walk right up to him, you know. That's just the way I am. I'm not easily intimidated or easily scared. So again, our prayer should be that since we are citizens of heaven, we should invoke those protections as well. Let me share you an interesting story. I mean, again, I grew up with uncles that were conscientious objectors. I grew up knowing both World War II veterans who had served in Germany and their conscientious objector counterparts who were still alive at that time, and I heard the stories of both. And I heard the stories about young men 18 years old sitting in front of a draft board and giving a defense for their belief. And, you know, if you want to relegate this doctrine to the opinion, well, I mean, you have your opinion and I have my opinion, well, take that to a draft board and see how it works for you. So I remember listening to those stories, but so one of the things that was really, really important is consistency. You know, you can't have some people in a church that believe one way and act on it. I mean, in other words, you have church members with concealed carry permits that come to church packing heat, and then have other members of the same church claim that they're conscientious objectors. That'll create a lot of fun for the legal department if it ever comes up. Doesn't work. So then one of the big things was hypocrisy. So do you really believe this? And many of the conscientious objectors in our community worked in local hospitals. And one particular story that comes to my mind is two orderlies that were working in a mental institution. And everybody that was there knew that they were conscientious objectors. And the Amish have kind of an added dimension to that, also called non-resistance, based on just turning the other cheek, which Jesus taught. So they said, look, you have this deranged guy, and he's wielding a knife over there in the room. You know, go remedy the situation. They prayed, and then they were innovative. So what they did is they went into the room and hauled a mattress. Took a mattress, and you know how big a mattress is, and I know what you're thinking, and they chumped on him. That's not what they did. They took the mattress and tried to force it through a door, but standing up. So you get a full-size mattress and you try to press it through the door, and obviously it wouldn't fit. And they're pushing on this mattress and pushing on a mattress and trying to get through, and the mentally deranged guy with the knife stood there watching the poor sorry folks. He dropped his knife and came to their assistance. One of the guys took the knife while he wasn't watching, and so the situation was mitigated. You see, it is, like many other things, an issue of faith when it comes right down to it. And we should never underestimate God's ability to intervene on our behalf if we actually believe what we say we do. I mean, if we don't, I mean, if you're part of the Church of God and you've decided to pack heat to protect yourself, it's the same thing that the Israelites did when they took matters into their own hands. We do that a lot of times. But if you, as a Church of God member, are packing heat, remember what you're going to make life difficult for people who actually believe what we teach. I mean, that's just a fact. Another thing that might be of interest, I mean, how many of you have seen Hacksaw Ridge? A couple of you. It's a movie that is worth watching because there was a conscientious objector to war. He called himself a conscientious cooperator. His name was Desmond Doss. And he was an Army Ranger, and he was the first conscientious objector to win the Medal of Honor. I mean, this really sounds like a contradiction. He was drafted, and he refused to bear arms, but he didn't refuse to go into service. He said, look, I'm here to save lives, not to take them. He became an Army medic. And the reason that he did this as he believed in the Sabbath. I think he was a Seventh-day Adventist, if I remember correctly. And he didn't carry a gun into battle, but he was never, I've got some information here, but he was never unarmed. He carried with him his Bible and undying faith. So here are some more facts about him. Doss believed that he should preserve life rather than take life based on his personal application of the Sixth Commandment. Therefore, he chose not to carry a gun in combat. Because of his belief in the Sabbath and his desire to worship God, Doss did not work on the seventh day of the week, Saturday. However, he picked up extra duties and worked long hours the rest of the week to make up for it. I mean, the interesting thing is, there's also there are two known conscientious objectors in World War II. One is Desmond Doss, and this is in Japan. There's a German counterpart to it. I think the title of that book, A Thousand May Fall. And these two men managed to go through the entire war without killing anybody and did huge exploits. I mean, Doss, in the assault on Hacksaw Ridge, let me see how many people he saved here. Medal of Honor. So on May 2nd and 4th, he rescued five soldiers under a shower of grenades, small arms fire, and mortar barrages. On May the 2nd, he rescued a man 200 yards behind enemy lines. May the 5th, Doss rescued an artillery officer and carried him 100 yards to safety, although he was only 25 feet from the enemy. So you get within 25 feet of the enemy, you pick up a guy and you walk him back to safety, and they live. And then the The biggest one was shown in the movie where he carried 100 soldiers back to safety and lowered them down on a rope. I mean, it's just an unbelievable demonstration of faith and bravery. In fact, in the movie, they were ordered to get back up and fight, but the company refused to go until Desmond Doss had said his prayers. As all the other companies suffered huge losses. You see, as is the case in so many other things, unless we exercise faith, God is not able to intervene on our behalf. Now, let's think about this concept. In Acts chapter 11, verse 26, believers were first called Christian, which, I mean, that designator has been rightly and wrongly applied as people who follow Christ. There are those who profess to follow Christ, and then there are those who follow Christ. And if we are literally a follower of the Christ who died on the cross at the hands of Roman soldiers, and 11 of the 12 apostles died a premature and martyr's death for their faith, I mean, this flies into the face of self-preservation arguments fundamental to the concealed carry arguments. I mean, it just, you know, if you follow Christ, he ended up nailed on a cross prior to his resurrection. So when Jesus says that his servants won't fight, that's what he said. That's what the expectation is, whether or not we die in the process of following him is a well-documented consequence of being a follower of Christ down through history. I mean, that's just, you know, how many people have, for various reasons, in the past and today, I might add, died for their faith. Many have. And again, you know, when the question is, what do you do? What is appropriate for self-preservation? And the church's teaching, and I know this simply because I was in Pasadena and other places and served on security. And what we were taught is you can use non-lethal restraint. I mean, you can restrain somebody if you're able to do that. The doctrine says that we are forbidden by commandment of God from taking human life. Doesn't mean you can't restrain somebody. So, you know, when I was on security at Ambassador Auditorium and other places in Big Sandy, that was the approach. And, you know, the one thing I've learned, too, is most of your really boisterous people are big cowards. I mean, that's just a fact. But, I mean, we've got enough situations today where, you know, there's violence and killing and all of that. The question is, it comes back to what we're asking here. The first thing is, we believe that Christians. So what have Christians done down through time in this regard? Let me give you a couple of quotes here. This is from Theophilus of Antioch, who was probably a part of the Church of God and written about 180 A.D. Consider, therefore, whether those who teach such things can possibly live indifferently and be commingled with unlawful intercourse. Most impious of all, especially, and here's the quote, especially when, quote, we are forbidden so much as to witness shows of gladiators, lest we become partakers and abettors of murders, but neither may we see other spectacles, lest our eyes and ears be defiled. So in 180 AD, according to Theophilus of Antioch, two Christians did not believe they were to fight nor even watch violent sports that were popular in the second century. You know, think about all the violence that is marketed today as entertainment. Theophilus of Antioch said that that would defile our eyes and ears. We become insensitized to those kinds of things. Pacifism is characteristic of the early centuries of Christianity, and someone like the North African apologist Tertullian, 160 to 220 AD, who regularly warned Christians to distance themselves from pagan culture. You know, this sounds legitimate. He wrote the following: "How will he serve in the army, even during peacetime, without the sword that Jesus Christ has taken away? Even if soldiers came to John and got advice on how they ought to act, even if the centurion became a believer, the Lord, by taking away Peter's sword, disarmed every soldier thereafter. We are not allowed to wear any uniform that symbolizes a sinful act." Then we have here the 3rd century Roman presbyter that wrote in the apostolic tradition, Canon 6, quote, "A soldier in lower ranks shall kill no one. If ordered to do so, he shall not obey. He shall not take an oath. If he does not want to comply with this directive, let him be dismissed from the church." That was in 200 AD. And then finally, we have here, into the early Middle Ages, some in the true Church of God were called Waldensians, though most called their name were not in the Church of God, and these were all pacifists. Notice this description of them. I mean, you're probably all familiar with the Waldensians. They were a church in the Swiss Alps in the Middle Ages. "Their opposition to bearing arms and to war in all its operations was unanimous and unequivocal. Whoever commanded them to the field, they refused to obey, alleging that they could not be conscientiously comply." And this is quoted from Davis Tamar, A General History of the Sabbatarian Churches, printed in 1851. So the second component of the fundamental of belief was that Christians are, quote, "forbidden by the commandments of God from taking human life directly or indirectly." Let's go back to, and I've commented on this, let's go back to Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 13 in the New King James Version says, "You shall not murder." And that is, I believe, the best and most accurate translation. Many also say, "You shall not kill." So the question, as I mentioned earlier, when it comes down to the question of why was David a warrior in the Old Testament, and why not in the New? Well, the answer is because we are today the Church of God, and as members of the Kingdom of God, our citizenship is in heaven, and our King, who is soon to come, said that his servants at this time will not fight. We are to come out of the world. We are to, as we will read in a minute, turn the other cheek, do all kinds of things that go contrary to human nature, this just being one of them. Matthew chapter 5. And again, as I mentioned, the Anabaptist tradition bases its entire theological argument on some of the scriptures we're about to read. And again, it's an approach to the topic, but I believe the citizenship argument in connection with John chapter 18, verse 36, in which Christ said, "You shall not fight," is a much more cohesive framework for understanding because it makes allowance for what God had Israel do in the Old Testament. Matthew chapter 5, verse 21. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of judgment. But I say to you, whoever is angry with his brother without a cause shall be in danger of judgment. So Jesus raises the bar here and says and points to the spiritual source, if you will, of murder. Murder does not occur without hate first being a part of the mindset. So his the spiritual intent of the law is enumerated here, and not only are we not to murder and to kill, but rather to deal with the emotions and thinking that leads up to that. Just continuing over a page, in verse 38, you have heard that it was said, an eye for eye and tooth for tooth, but I tell you not to resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on the right cheek, to turn the other to him also. If anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, you do not turn away. I mean, these are all, I mean, here's an enumeration of expectations that Jesus Christ has of us as his follower that defy human nature. And this is not an easy road, but nothing worth doing is easy. Continuing, verse 43, and you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good and sends rain on the just and the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? I mean, he's drawing a contrast here that the Old Testament construct of loving your neighbor and hating your enemy, I mean, that's easy. Let's elevate it to a new and different way of thinking. Verse 47, and if you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than the others? Do not even the tax collectors do so? Therefore, you shall be perfect just as your Father in heaven is perfect. I mean, that provides a context for the statement of perfection. Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12, verse 17. Repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. I mean, this is a truism, but also a hard saying, because, you know, it is just so natural to not get mad, but to get even. Actually, when you think about it, it's better to get mad, because Paul said, be angry, but do not sin. Not getting mad, but getting even, as the popular phrase goes, is not a biblical concept. Jesus also said, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. He also said that by this you shall know that you are, that people shall know that you are my disciples because you have love for one another. And think about that in the context of a military conflict. The Church of God has always had members all over the world. If we had as a fundamental belief participation in military service and war, you would have disciples killing each other as opposed to demonstrating that they are following Jesus Christ by loving one another. And now the third point. There were three in this first sentence of the fundamental belief. There were three parts. I will just read all three. We believe that Christians are forbidden by the commandments of God from taking human life directly or indirectly. And then you have this handy little word, and that bearing arms is contrary to this fundamental belief. So packing heat is contrary to this fundamental belief. So you ask yourself, I think that raises a legitimate question. Why so? You know, why not just... You know, this fundamental belief is framed under the title military service in war, not concealed carry or packing heat or however you want to characterize it. So how are the two connected? You know, or are the two connected? I mean, the fundamental belief connects it. I mean, if you look at our fundamental beliefs, I mean, they're pretty solid. I mean, somebody did some pretty good thinking when he put these things together. Notice, I'll read this. I want to read this again. We believe that Christians, and that's a differentiator. You're not a Christian? Hey. All is fair game. If you want to be a true Christian, we believe that they are forbidden by the commandment of God from taking human life directly or indirectly, and that bearing arms is contrary to this fundamental belief. So the notion of packing heat is, in fact, by the very words that we just read, against this fundamental belief. So you're in the wrong place if you're here. It's just as simple as that. But the question is, are these two connected or can you differentiate? So let's think about this for a little bit. So you have conscientious objection to war. And that is something that is, I think, broadly understood because of, you know, Hacksaw Ridge, I think, did a really good job. I haven't read the book, so maybe there may be inaccuracies, but I'm just watching the movie. It did a really good job of showing an individual who could in no way be construed as a coward. I mean, he's walking around the battlefield saving lives under fire, and God honored that commitment. I mean, he should have gotten killed, and some maybe did. That's not the point. I mean, that's God's prerogative. Because when we signed up, as far as I can remember, we were to, what's the word, unconditionally surrender our lives to Jesus Christ, right? So an unconditional surrender, you know, what is that? What happens when a country unconditionally surrenders? It becomes up to the victor to decide their fate, does it not? Our life is no different. Our victor, Jesus Christ, decides our fate. And he can decide whether or not to protect for his glory or to seal our fate for glory. But back to the question, are the two connected? Here's why they are. If conscientiously objecting to serve in the military to protect our country from enemies, foreign and domestic, if we do that, we cannot at the same time claim it is right to bear arms to protect ourselves or our family. And here's why. This is hypocritical. Such a position is hypocritical and fundamentally selfish. And the reason is that protecting the country is simply the protection of the sum total of all families in the nation. So if we conscientiously object to protecting the whole, it is both illogical and hypocritical to then pack heat to protect our own. So if it is wrong to take arms to protect all families, then it is also wrong to take up arms to protect one family, meaning our own. Brethren, it's important that we know the truth. Because it is the truth that sets us free. Not the U.S. Constitution that we celebrate on the 4th of July, and I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't, because the Constitution provides protections that we have enjoyed to our great benefit and to our hurt over the past 241 years now. But it is the truth that actually protects. And when we have two constitutions that have contradictory positions, then as for me and my house, we will choose to serve the Lord.